Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm Colleen Johnson, and we are joined today by guest Dominica DeGrandis. Hello, Dominica.
Hi, Colleen. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Dominica is an expert in Kanban and making work visible, and her new book just came out. So we'll be spending some time today talking about her new book, Making Work Visible, and a little bit about your background in DevOps in particular and why Kanban is such a natural fit for DevOps work. Let's start. You had the opportunity to be part of the very early Kanban work that took place at Corbis, which is one of the earliest projects I think I know of when we talk about where Kanban got its roots. Can you share a little bit about that project for our audience?
Yeah, you bet. This would have been in 2005, 2006, back at Corbis in Seattle. And we had been struggling trying to do sustainment work. We were doing big batch size releases, maybe getting something out every 6 months. And one of the UX developers wanted to come up with a way that we could do frequent, small changes and get them into production. Things that customers were complaining about, where previously those would have had to have been tied to some project in order, you know, bundled in to get them to production because of how the whole budgeting, accounting, finance process worked, right? Everything's got to have a project. And so we started doing these small releases to production every 2 weeks. And the criteria for that was that it didn't take anybody more than half a day to do that. And so this is kind of the state we were in. We were just sort of starting to make a little bit of progress. And then this Scottish fellow came around. He was working at Microsoft. And of course, I'm talking about David J. Anderson. And he had met up with one of our business analysts at a conference, I think in Chicago somewhere. And they got to talking and we started reading his first book that he wrote about agile project management. And anyway, the short of it is that he came to do, in exchange for David spending one day a month with us, that he would get a case study out of our journey, our agile journey that we were doing. And so that turned into him actually coming on board full time. And so he was my boss. I worked directly for David for, you know, a good year and a half or so. And we started, we put a board up. And we weren't really calling it Kanban in the beginning. We were just trying to improve the flow of work and be able to do these sustainment releases more frequently. And over time, we made things visible. We introduced work in progress limits. And we really didn't know exactly what we were doing. We just sort of went for it. We started having stand-ups in front of this board, and we did gradual changes. I remember the first board we had didn't have the build, did not have release management or the build team as part of the workflow. And I remember feeling personally insulted by that because I was like, we're right smack in the middle of everything. We're doing the configuration management. We're building out the tools. We're trying to automate the process. We communicate, we're pushing releases to dev and test and staging and production and doing all this coordination. And it was like, because our state wasn't on the board, it made it seem like our work was all invisible, like we weren't part of the team. And so anyway, I made that case. And then shortly after that, then we had a build. We got a build column on the board. And it's funny, Colleen, because later on, I don't know, like 9 months later, the releases became quite smooth. They would go out on a Wednesday around 5 or 6 p.m., you know, after the East Coast slowed down. And there would be no issues. Initially, doing a release without an issue, it would just never happen because we had been doing these large batch size releases every 6 months. it would take us all weekend. You know, we got to bring production down and let's just pray that we've got production up and running again by Monday morning before New York comes online. And so we watched this progression, but it's easy to forget how, you know, when you're making small gradual change over the course of 12 months, it was like I felt like I woke up one day and asked myself, how did we get here? Like, how did we get from this almost crisis mode of delivery with releases to now these very smooth releases on Wednesday that took maybe 1 hour and everybody got to go home for dinner?
Yeah, that's nice. And it's sad that's the anomaly, right? I mean, we talk a lot in Kanban about finding that sustainable pace of work, but that really is something that eludes so many of us in the software industry.
Yeah. I just wonder how much of it has to do with how organizations get their funding, how teams get their funding. I think it's one reason why we see this big change now in the DevOps movement of going from projects to product teams, where the focus is all around the product and you have all the skill sets you need and everything you need on the product side, and you're not relying on trying to find a clever way to get your changes into an already established project.
Definitely. In your new book, you talk about time thieves. Mm-hmm. Can you share a little bit about your concept here of time thieves. What they are?
Yeah. Well, this came about, you know, I was working on the book and I was trying to find a way to help people understand the problem with hidden and invisible work and all the damage that that does. And so I thought, you know, well, hidden and unplanned, it sounds kind of like theft. And then I realized, you know, it really is. It's time theft. There's these time thieves that, we don't protect ourselves from hours being stolen. We allow these time thieves to steal from us day after day after day. So I write about the five thieves of time, which if we could see and measure the impact of, could, I think, really help us improve performance. So the time thieves are too much work in progress. So that's where we've got all this work that has started, but it hasn't finished yet. We got a lot of balls juggling in the air. There's thief unknown dependencies. So these are the things that we aren't aware of, and they need to happen before another piece of work can be finished. And this could either be architecture, or maybe an expert, or just an activity that has to happen first. And then thief unplanned work. These are all the interruptions that prevent you from finishing something, or at least from stopping at a better breaking point. And then thief conflicting priorities. This is where projects and tasks consistently compete with each other. And that's exacerbated when we're uncertain of what the most important thing to do is, because everything's a priority one. And then lastly is thief neglected work. And this is the work, the partially completed work that doesn't get any love, it doesn't get budget, it doesn't get the attention it needs, and it sits idle on the bench, lonely. And so the book is really about how to confront the thieves, how to bring visibility to them so that you can begin to, you know, chase them away and sort of take back the day, so you can start delivering business value or customer value or however your organization defines value, and just really improve performance in that manner.
And I love the concept of unplanned work being a thief of our time. I think on the flip side of that, one of the questions I hear a lot when I'm working with Kanban teams or teams that are new to Kanban or very used to Scrum, they have a question around how does planned work fit into a Kanban system? And so I think one of the things I liked about your book is it also addresses how does unplanned work fit into a Kanban system. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah. Well, I mean, my background is configuration management and build and release and automation. And for that world, there's a lot of unplanned work. you know, issue, I mean, production goes down, you lose a node, SQL Server hits 100% capacity utilization. There's just, you know, seems like every day there's an issue. So there's a lot of unplanned work. And if the unplanned work isn't tracked, I mean, there's no ticket for it. There's no ticket that says do this unplanned work, right? So usually there's no ticket for it in the beginning. And all of a sudden you're troubleshooting some issue or some incident. And you're right, you may create a ticket for it after the fact, or maybe when you're in the middle of it. And by ticket, Colleen, I mean a work item type or what, you know, whatever tool you use to do your workflow process, something gets created, hopefully. The problem is that oftentimes unplanned work doesn't have a work item associated with it, and then it becomes invisible. And if you have a lot of unplanned work, then there's no traceability of why you didn't get your planned work done, right? They're competing with each other. Unplanned work competes with planned work, but we have visibility on the planned work. And you have a project manager with a plan or a scrum master, you know, working to get some functionality done in the 2-week sprint. And then something comes up out of the blue that delays the delivery of that fix or for that feature. And we don't know, you know, why that is, if that work is hidden, if it's not made visible. It comes into play when, say, you've got, you know, maybe you're working on the DevOps side and you're building out a new integration platform or you know, just building out maybe developments, building out some new microservices in Docker containers or something. And you've got a deadline for it. You know, it's due at the end of the month, but in the middle of the month, you've got, you know, maybe you have a security breach, or maybe you're working with some offshore teams who maybe they don't understand the limits of your database architecture. So, I mean, there's like a million things that can happen. You know, people get sick, the car goes in the shop, somebody goes off to school. And so there will always, I'm not saying that, I'm not, my point here is not to try and reduce unplanned work down to zero. That, I think, we're delusional if we think we can do that. There will always be unplanned work. We just need to plan for unplanned work and acknowledge that it's what can prevent the planned work from being delivered when you thought it would be. And it's a way to help bring visibility to it so that management and leadership, they can communicate their, I didn't say that right. What I meant to say was, making unplanned work visible and tracking it and measuring it allows teams to present data and metrics to show their management, to show leadership why planned work isn't ready yet, why business value that they thought they could deliver at the end of the month isn't going to happen.
And I think that's all very valuable, regardless of whether you're following a Kanban, the Kanban method, or the Scrum, you know, Scrum approach, or a blend of those two. You need both of those metrics to really understand what the data is telling you.
Absolutely. It's why I see a lot of teams doing some form of Scrumban, you know, because they've been doing Scrum for a while, so it's deeply embedded in their organization. But then there's this acknowledgement that we've got a lot of unplanned work too, and or we have work that maybe needs to get done in less than a week, or we know it's going to take longer than a week or two to do. So let's just add another lane at the bottom of our Scrum board for another team, maybe an ops team, or for unplanned work that doesn't follow the same release cadence as the work that the Scrum teams might be doing. I mean, that's really, they're more, Kanban and Scrum are more alike than they are different. They're both agile methods. They both have constraints. They both try to make work visible. It's just the constraints are different. With Scrum, you got the time-boxed sprint. And with Kanban, you got the work in progress limits. So it's just a different way to intentionally put some tension or some pressure into this system to help people focus on delivering.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love that. I think there's often so much comparison of what's different about the two approaches. We often forget to stop and look at, you know, the similarities, and there are a lot.
Yeah. And the thing with Kanban, start where you are. Well, if your teams are all doing Scrum, then that's your starting point. But how do we now add some of the benefits of Kanban, like setting work in progress limits so teams aren't completely overwhelmed? And how can we bring some of the lean metrics into it, which is one of my favorite topics, is the metrics that we can get. If you've got a nice tool doing where your compound cards are flowing through.
Yeah, definitely. So you talked about one of the time thieves being neglected work. And I liked you refer back to Donald Reinertsen's work with the sunk cost fallacy, which is that mm-hmm. I have to finish this because I started it. So I loved your advice that we need to get more comfortable in abandoning those zombie projects that are sitting there because we feel like we have to come back to them and finish them just because we started it.
Yeah.
How do you recommend teams, and you recommend in the book, like, let's consider instead consider what is the investment to finish this work. Do you have a recommendation for how to visualize that?
I thought you were going in a different direction there. So you're asking, how does one visualize neglected work?
Yep. And not just how do we visualize the neglected work, but how do we visualize that gap of what's left? So what you mentioned, like the investment to finish.
Yeah. Well, the way to visualize neglected work is to make sure that first it's on your board. And it will be, after a while it becomes obvious because this card, this thing that's neglected, whatever it is, it's sitting on the same spot on the board day after day after day, maybe week after week after week. It's not moving. It's not flowing. And which is one reason why it's important to do your Kanban design so that the work is flowing most of the time. And that way it's easy to spot something that's not flowing. And then the question becomes, why is this thing not moving? You know, is this an expensive piece of business value that's just sitting there? Why is that? And then we come to find out that it's probably because it's competing with all these other things that are deemed a higher priority. So one way to get out of that is to have a necessary conversation on how work is being prioritized. And when you look at prioritization, that's when the cost of delay can come into the conversation, if that's what teams are using. And that's what I talk about in the book, is that thing that is sitting there not moving is the cost of the delay of that business value higher than other work that's on the board. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Because a lot of times priorities are made by, you know, really who's screaming the loudest or who's in the highest position of power. And some people will talk about ROI. Oh, well, this has a higher return on investment than, you know, A has a higher return on investment than B. But what ROI does not consider is time. Well, what if this thing, what's the difference in potential business value if item A is delivered 30 days late? What does that do to the value? And so, I just lost my train of thought there. We're talking about neglected work and the problems with not considering higher value work.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what you talk about in the book with our, we feel like because we have to start something, you know, because we've started something that we have to finish it. Oh. So that concept of abandoning those projects that that may have a longer investment or a more, you know, a more costly investment to finish them, and less value, right? So it's kind of a combination of those two factors in a lot of ways of what's the investment to finish it and what's the cost of delay.
Yeah. Also, when I was at Corbis, we had done a lot of work on one project, like 6 months worth of work, and that project got cut. It got axed. And the morale hit that it had on the team was terrible. People were like, I spent 6 months working on this thing and now it's going to get cut. Are you kidding me? And they actually drew a little, somebody drew a, because our board was physical at that time on the whiteboard, and on the board right next to it, somebody drew a garbage can with a square around it. And then they put that card in the garbage can area as a, you know, that was a statement being made. Like all this work that we did just went into the garbage. So there's the sunk cost right there. Not understanding that it was competing with other work that was seen to have a higher value, a higher cost of delay. And so that's why that other work needed to go. But I think in order for that, work to be abandoned like that, for those zombie projects to be abandoned, there needs to be a mindset shift that some of our work is experimental in nature. And not all of it is going to make it to production. And if we can help teams understand that, then if some of the work doesn't make it to production, at least there's an expectation there that that's what's happening and they don't feel like all their work was wasted and that we have this big sunk cost.
Yeah, I love that. That's that kind of embracing that as a learning opportunity, right?
Exactly. That's what... I don't know if you've listened to John Osbaugh's talk yet. That was just given in San Francisco in November. But he's talking about how every incident is a tremendous business opportunity to learn from.
Yeah, that makes sense. One of the other parts about your book that I really enjoyed was the psychology that you talk about around why we always feel like we have to say yes to take on more work. Can you talk about that? I'm the worst at this. Everyone in my family gives me such a hard time because I'm so bad at saying no. So this totally resonates.
Yes. Yeah. There's a handful of reasons why we say yes a lot. And one of the main reasons is because we love pulling one off for the team. We are team players. We have our team that we work with, and we don't want to let our team down. So we say yes for the team, even though it means that we're setting other teams up to be completely overwhelmed. We set ourselves up and we set our teams up for being overwhelmed. But yeah, we do it because we're a team player. We also hate to say no to the boss. And I find that very interesting because people want to say yes. We get, I forget if it's dopamine or serotonin, but you know, we feel good when we say yes. And we don't like saying no. So we say yes to people we like. We say yes to the boss. And it could be that the boss just wants to know, they're thinking about maybe doing some third-party integration, and they just want to know like how long that might take. And come to find out down the road, people thought that was a mandate to go do this thing, and they stopped work on one thing and started working on this other thing, and that wasn't what the VP had in mind at all. So when the boss asks people to do something, I think that's one of the biggest lessons that senior leadership in particular can take away if they're listening to this podcast, is when you consider carefully when you ask people if they can do something or to do something, because they want to do it and they will say yes, and they will go above and beyond and overwhelm teams and themselves just to get it done. And it could delay the delivery of some other higher important piece of business value. Other things why we say yes, we like to work on new stuff. New, fresh, shiny things are much funner to start than toying away and kind of older, unglamorous kind of work. Maybe some old legacy work or a security audit or something. The idea of working on something new and fresh is exciting to us. So we say yes to that. And let's see, did I ramble off five there? Did I get five? We do work for people we like, for the boss. We don't want to say no to the team because we're team players. We are people, you know, there's people pleasers yeah. too, just in general. It doesn't matter if it's somebody from your team or you know, somebody on the other coast. It's just, we like to say yes because then we provide value for people, right? People will see us as we can. We're valuable. Our sense of value improves.
I often have a hard time convincing teams why they need a WIP limit on their to-do column. And I really liked what you said just now around the new stuff is more fun. I always tell them, you know, you might think you know what you're going to be working on for the next 2 weeks, but we want to be flexible and be able to respond on, you know, on demand to new requests coming in. But the other part of that that I think I don't disclose is that I don't want you to have 2 weeks worth of options where you can pick the things that are the most fun from that bucket.
Yeah. Yes. Because that's what, you know, given the choice, that's what they'll do if there's no clear prioritization method.
You say WIP limits actually give people that permission to say no. Can you explain how that works?
Yeah. Well, because we like to say yes all the time, if there's no WIP limit, then we don't have that added support to say no. A WIP limit is an enabling constraint. It's what lets us focus on the most important work and get it done before taking on new work. It's the WIP limit is what gives us permission to say, sorry, I can't take that on right now. We are full. You know, our WIP limit for our team is whatever, 12. And we're already doing 12 things. So if you need us to take on a 13th thing, then basically we have to stop working on one of these things. And that's going to be expensive because it's already in motion. People are already assigned the work and they're already working on it. And it would be likely less expensive if we could just finish that one thing before pulling this new thing in. So the WIP limit, it's the constraint. It's like in Scrum when somebody wants to add a new feature into the items that you've already agreed to on the sprint, right? You get to say, oh, sorry, you know, we're in this sprint now. We can take that on in our next sprint. The problem is if you're fully allocated and then you have an emergency or you have unplanned work, that's a high priority that now consumes the team's time, which is why some of the ways we see people work with that is to allocate some of that WIP limit for unplanned work.
What is your take on the expedite lane debate?
The expedite lane debate as far as where it should be or how should there be a WIP limit on it? Or
we recently interviewed Dan Vacanti and we've talked to a few other Kanban folks who it seems to be very divided on whether or not there's even validity to having an expedite lane, since the Kanban system in a lot of ways should be able to adapt to that urgent work coming in just through a low enough work in progress limit.
Here's my take on that. The key word you said there was should. How many organizations are at that level of maturity where they're actually doing that? I would say very few. There's a lot of organizations there that are just, you know, they're treading water. They're completely overwhelmed with work. And so introducing Kanban into their system, it's you know, there's a point where they're just starting out, or it takes a long time to get to that level of maturity where I think a Kanban system is that smooth that you can just handle that kind of unplanned work. To me, the Kanban boards are not all the same. It depends on the context and the problems people are trying to solve. So if expedites are a problem in the organization, then yes, let's make them visible. Let's have a swim lane for them at the top of the board so that we can get visibility on it. We can measure them. The incidents, the expedited column is going to provoke conversations about why we're having so many incidents or expedites and what to do about it. And they're going to move into the retrospective that needs to be discussed. They're not going to get lost as easily. But if your organization is at a high maturity level and you're able to balance your capacity with the demand and they're not an issue, then maybe you have other things you'd rather consume that real estate on the board.
I like what you were saying too about, you know, that part of this is just having enough information to make that decision, right? So that when somebody makes a request, and you talked about executive leadership, understanding the weight of their, you know, what seems to be a simple request, I think so often they don't have enough information to weigh the impact of that request either. So it can seem like a simple request when they're asking for something because they don't have all of that information in front of them to understand that this simple request is going to stop these other three things that are in flight.
Yeah.
That's part of what this visibility enables, right?
Exactly. And it's not that, you know, I think sometimes VPs or execs get the bad rap, but they're just like everybody else too. We don't know how long things are going to take. That's one of the things I forgot on why we say yes, because we don't realize how long things are going to take. And things always take longer than we think, always. And so, especially other people's work, we think other people should be able to get, you know, like I could do that job faster, but not the case. And same with VPs. I've seen teams that have a VP lane on their board in lieu of an expedite lane. Just kind of, you know, the VP is calling up their favorite sysadmin to do something and is unaware of the impacts that it has to some of the other items than a VP lane or something, you know, leadership lane or something that shows the demand that's coming in outside of the system can be valuable.
You got your origins, as you mentioned, in the Kanban world in DevOps and release management. And I wanted to ask you if you, now that you've worked with multiple different companies and had the opportunity to see Kanban work for different types of projects, what's your advice for teams that are working on more of a planned deliverable or fixed deliverable type of project versus unplanned work?
Well, if the demand is mostly planned in nature, and they don't have a lot of unplanned work, then it's probably going to have a much smoother flow to it. I mean, then the question is, what is the problem? Where is the pain that we need to make visible? I mean, I don't know. Give me an example. Like, I mean, there's got to be, if everything is smooth, then I would argue you don't really need a constraint or need Kanban if everything is rolling really smooth. Yeah, I work with marketing teams and finance and product and biz dev, and just about every day I know has unplanned work.
No, and I think that's probably a fallacy of those fixed deliverable or fixed scope projects, right? That they're never as cut and dry as we'd like to think they are, and hopefully we're providing some space for some of that in a Kanban system.
Yeah, I just think it's there's probably some problems. There's probably something that could be improved. And so asking the team what prevents them from getting their work done, that's the question. And then that becomes the pain point. You know, where's the constraint in your system? How do we improve that? Maybe there's, you know, specialized skill sets. You know, maybe there's just one person who does Ruby. I don't know. One skill set and everything funnels through him. And so that's the constraint. Okay, so now we know we need to cross-train other team members on that skill so that we don't set ourselves up for a risk on dependencies and high coordination costs.
Well, Dominica, do you have any upcoming presentations or upcoming places where people can find you or learn more about your work?
Yeah, I'm going to be in Austin next week. I am in Austin the week of January 15th. I'm speaking at a couple meetups there at Cloud Austin and Agile Austin before I do a two-day Kanban Flow workshop for an organization in San Antonio. And then I'm going to be at Lean Agile US. I'm talking about the balanced calendar, which I'm pretty excited about because ultimately, even if, you know, it's essential, I think, and necessary to make work visible and to have work in progress limits. But if we don't also consider our calendar, then it's not going to be as big of a win because face it, some people are booked solid in meetings all day long. So I'm doing a talk about how we can optimize our time and work to have a more balanced calendar. So that's at Lean Agile US in Fort Lauderdale last week in February. I've got a couple other conferences coming up in April and May. I guess the big one will be the DevOps Enterprise Summit in London in June.
Wonderful. And you blog at ddegrandis.com?
I do. My blog is at ddegrandis.com. And got my new book out that I'm pretty excited about called Making Work Visible, Exposing Time Theft to Optimize Work and Flow. And it's available through all the channels, Kindle, audio, Amazon, Barnes & Nobles, all the various outlets.
I've already recommended it to a few of my clients I've been working with. I think it's, I think it's very common for us to use David Anderson's, what we refer to as the Blue Book.
The Blue Book, yes.
Starting teams out, but that's a very heavy book. And so, you know, I recommend it for some of these teams that are very new to Kanban that they start with this work, making work visible with your book that they really understand the roots of why the practices are there before we get into so much of the mechanics.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yeah. I just felt like there was a real need for making work visible in our community and in industry in general. It's actually in the business section, the ISBN numbers and the business book section of the bookstores, not the technical section. I wanted there to be a book out there that didn't feel like it was a heavy textbook. Something that was light and fun and had lots of examples and exercises in it that people could you know, there was a lot of utility in it that they could take back and start doing the following day.
Definitely. Well, you did a great job with it. And thank you for putting it out there. It's I can see that it's going to be a great tool for folks that are new to Kanban. And like we said, it's not just a Kanban book. I mean, I think all of these practices in terms of understanding where you're spending time and understanding what is taking time away from your productivity, that applies to Scrum and Scrumban and methods outside Agile as well.
Yeah. You know, some of the feedback people are giving me on the book is that it has this, it brings a human element to technology. And I love that because that's what I've been trying to do. I want to help teams because, you know, most people are, they're raising their kids, right? They got the family, they're raising the kids, they're going to work, and they're just exhausted and they're overwhelmed and they don't get to work on their most important work until they put the kids to bed at night. And so we have all these sleep-deprived technologists out there who aren't able to get their work done during the day because there's back-to-back meetings all day long. And I think we need to be more considerate of our workforce. And that's kind of the heart of the work that I want to do is really bring this human element into our work, and how can we help teams do the work of their life in a way that they can enjoy it and feel good about it, that delivers the highest business value as quickly as possible.
Putting the people back in to the process.
Yes.
Well, I want to thank you again, Domenica, and to everyone listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a review, a rating, or leave comments on iTunes, Stitcher, or the podcasting platform of your choice. It really helps others find us. And if this is your first time tuning in, consider subscribing so you don't miss any of our other great content. If you'd like to join the discussion and share your stories around Kanban, Time Thieves, or any other great books that are coming out, please join us at thecoalition.agileuprising.com. And finally, support from listeners like you help us cover our hosting and production costs. So see the show notes for details on how you can become a patron. Thank you again, Domenica.
Thank you, Colleen.
Now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
That doesn't sound good.
Paper shredder's jammed, but I think I fixed it.
Oh, well, try shredding these $50 bills then.
Seems like it's working.
Better try another $400.
Stop. Instead of using money, use regular paper. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.
For the ones who get it done, the most important part is the one you need now. And the best partner is the one who can deliver. That's why millions of maintenance and repair pros trust Grainger. Because we have professional-grade supplies for every industry, even hard-to-find products. And we have same-day pickup and next-day delivery on most orders. But most importantly, we have an unwavering commitment to help keep you up and running. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.